when the Second World War ended in 1945, and the full dimensions of the Holocaust started to sink in, more than 6 million killed, and that the Jews and the entire Jewish infrastructure in Europe had been destroyed. There were about 250,000 Jews that had survived. In the beginning of 1946, many of those Jews tried to return to their original homes, be it in Poland and the Ukraine, Lithuania, and they were met there with pogroms. They were met with universal hatred. I have a friend, a woman that I know, that went back to her home just 10 years ago, you know, just to visit. And she walked in by her neighbor. And her neighbor said to her, Zlata, you're still alive? That was the greeting. So it became clear that they couldn't go back. And as I mentioned, you had 250, so they didn't know what to do with the 250,000 Jews, so the occupation forces, the American, the French, the British, and the Russians, created what were called the displaced person camp, the refugee camps, DP camps. Now the DP camps, those in the American section were run by General Patton, who was an anti-Semite, and he ran the camps like a concentration camp. Barbed wire, dogs, everything. Couldn't come in, couldn't come out. To such an extent that General Eisenhower reprimanded him and removed him from being in charge of it. Patton was killed shortly thereafter in an automobile accident. So the question became what to do with these people. In 1945, towards the end of the war, England held an election. And out of gratitude to Winston Churchill for saving them, they voted him out of office. And the Labour government came in, headed by Clement Attlee. Now, as long as Labour was in the opposition, they always were pro-Zionist. And they always complained that the government had a curfew on Jewish immigration to the land of Israel. They played the Jewish card. And there were a lot of Jews in the Labour Party, leftists. But when they got into power, the British Foreign Minister was a man by the name of Ernest Bevin, who was an out-and-out anti-Semite. And Bevin declared that British policy would be that they would allow no Jews to come to the land of Israel. President Truman sent a letter to Bevin asking that England should make a temporary exception and allow 100,000 Jews to come into what was then Palestine. It was still under the English mandate. And in order to alleviate the pressure on the DP camps. And America agreed to take in 50,000. Bevin, in one of his classic remarks, said he doesn't want the 100,000 in New York, so he's sending them to me. And England refused. The Jewish community here in Eretz Yisrael, the Yishuv, which had a strong sense of guilt over what happened during the war. See, we didn't have an Air Force then. You know, what if we could have sent a missile into Hitler, like C.P. Yassin? A missile into Stalin, right? So the world would look different. But we didn't have missiles then. So the Yishuv organized what they called the Bricha. Bricha means the escape. Escape from Europe. What they did, the American Jewry contributed the money, the Jews in Israel contributed the people, all kinds of Jews. Leftists, socialists, Dati, Haredi, Siddish, everybody. It was a time of unity. Because everybody realized that, you know, you couldn't afford the luxuries we can afford now. And I cannot tell you what the situation, the psychological. I was yet very young, barely bar mitzvah in the, when the state came. But I cannot tell you the depression there was in the Jewish world. Absolute depression. Crush. All the great centers of Torah were destroyed. All the great Talmidei Chachamim, with a few exceptions. All the Hasidic courts. All the vibrancy of Polish and Eastern European Jewry, everybody was gone, and nobody, it wasn't a house that didn't have a relative. Well, the earliest word that I remember in English is affidavit. Because in my father's and mother's home, they were trying to bring my uncle from Lithuania and his family, and in order to do so, you needed affidavits to get into the United States, that you wouldn't be a burden on America. But he had a job, so I went to my father's synagogue, hired 12 assistant rabbis. Got them in. The yeshiva had, I don't know, 300 guys on the faculty. So sometimes the State Department played along with him, sometimes it didn't. It was the luck of the draw. So we tried to get him, my father tried to get affidavits for his brother to come here. He never was able to get him in, and they were destroyed. My uncle and aunt and six cousins were all destroyed. So every house had a story like that. So what do? So that in the land of Israel, the Jews were pretty much aware that as long as England ran the country, there was not going to be much hope for the Jews here. Then there were about 500,000 Jews in Israel and about 1.5 million Arabs. And England had 70,000 troops here. England also had the British Navy and the Mediterranean patrolling to make certain that nobody got in. The blockade. Nevertheless, they organized this as a bricha, and the Americans especially looked the other way, and they came into the DP camps and organized the refugees. And they took them by land, by any way that they could. They marched across the Alps. And they came to ports in Italy. Italy and Yugoslavia were the two countries that were complicit in this. And there they had ships that were waiting. They loaded them on the ships. And then they tried to run the British blockade. 9 out of 10 ships didn't make it. The people were either sent back to Europe. Eventually, there were so many ships that were coming that the English established in Cyprus, again, the DP camps, which resemble concentration camps. And they sent eventually there were over 110,000 Jews in Cyprus that were homeless, destitute. And the Jewish world, the Joint Distribution Committee, others supported them. In Israel itself, in the land of Israel itself, there were three organizations that were armed militias. One was called Lehi, Lochamei Chirut Yisrael. The British called it the Stern Gang, because its leader was a man by the name of Avram Stern. The Stern Gang were mainly Haredi Jews from Yerushalayim here. And they were the most violent of the group. And they said that we'll drive England out with a guerrilla war. We'll force them to get out of the country. And so acts of what we would call today terrorism, right, were perpetrated. They blew up British military bases. They shot British soldiers. They ran a guerrilla war. But they were few in number. They weren't more than 350, 400. And the British persecuted them. Not only the British persecuted them, the Jews persecuted them. Ben-Gurion and the others, they objected to them very strongly. Many times they turned them over to the British. One of them eventually became the Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir. Was a member of Lehi. Second group was headed by Menachem Begin, who also became Prime Minister of Israel. You have to realize how unlikely these things are. And his group was called the Irgun Tzvai Leumi, Eitzel, which the British called the Irgun. And the Irgun also conducted a guerrilla war against the British, but with less violence, less random violence than the Stern Gang. What happened was that the British captured quite a number of these people, 15, 20 of them, and they sentenced them to be hanged. Rav Aryeh Levin, the tzaddik of Yerushalayim, was their rabbi. He went to visit them every Shabbos he made for them. 13 of them were eventually hanged. In retaliation, the Irgun and the Stern Gang kidnapped three British sergeants and hanged them in Tel Aviv. Well, that brought down, as you can imagine. Third group. So what happened was that the British arrested all Zionist leaders. They sent them off to Kenya. They exiled them. There were thousands of Jews in prison. And the third group was the Haganah, which was the largest, which was mainly labor Zionists, leftists. And the leaders of it, there was a group called the Palmach. That was all from the leftist kibbutzim. And they were the most moderate. Sometimes they cooperated with the Irgun, and sometimes they were against the Irgun. A lot of politics involved, as you can imagine, in the Jewish world, and a lot of it still remains today. It's still a leftover. It'll take another 100 years to work it through our system. Yeah?
With the Arabs of the Arab Palestinians, was it trying to get the British out?
They wanted the British to stay because the British were going to give them the country and give them complete domination over the Jews. Now, Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj Al-Amin Hussein, who is a distant cousin of Yasser, of Arafat, He cooperated with Hitler in the war. He called for an Arab uprising against the Allies. He begged Hitler to come and install the final solution here. if Rama would have won, God forbid, at El Alamein in 1943, then the German army would have been in Palestine. So the Haganah armed itself, and all the kibbutzim became storage places for arms and for the manufacture of arms. I had an uncle, passed away, a wonderful Jew, big Talmud Chacham, crazy Jew. He owned a metal finishing shop in Tel Aviv. He was making rifles for the Haganah the whole time, under the cover of this metal shop in the basement. All the kibbutzim have what is known as a slick. A slick is a hidden place underneath where they stored weapons. They just found now in the Golan a slick from 60 years ago that they forgot about. Still have the weapons. And the British embarked literally on a war of annihilation here against the Yishuv. And it was fed by Bevin's constant anti-Semitic statements. He said Jews always want to push themselves to the head of the queue. We have much more important problems in the world to deal with. And to Truman's credit, he kept the pressure on. Truman was a very complicated person. He was not an anti-Semite, but he was a guy from Missouri who talked about Jews the way guys from Missouri in the 1920s talked about Jews. So for him to say you're a kite or something was not an insult. That's just, you know, like they once used to say a black is a nigger, right? So they said it. But today it is unacceptable. But then that was the way they talked. And so what happened was that as the losses mounted for England, the casualties, and England, it became apparent that England was going to have to withdraw from India also. And it also became apparent that the empire was over. So the necessity for England to maintain the Suez Canal became less and less important. The Suez Canal was only important as far as India was concerned, and it was important only as far and until there were no airplanes, but with the development of air, etc., it began to lose its importance, and England could not afford to keep 70,000 troops here. It was absolutely bankrupt after the war. It exhausted all of its money. There was actual famine in England, and there was no coal in the winters of 46 and 47 in London. So they had to give up here. Couldn't afford to keep it going. So they decided that they would turn the problem over to the United Nations. Whatever the United Nations decided, that would be it. England was confident that the United Nations would say, in the end, the best thing is that it should remain under English control, and the United Nations will finance it, and England will continue to run it. England was also confident that the Jews would support it because of the fact that the Jews would otherwise be slaughtered by the Arabs. All the surrounding Arab countries proclaimed that they were going to slaughter the Jews. And the Jews were a minority in the country. And the Jewish world, as I told you, was destroyed. And the Jews in America were afraid to raise their heads. Not like today. Then you couldn't have Lieberman run for vice president. So England was confident that the United Nations would give them the mandate back again, and then they would have the finances to run it, and it would remain. What happened, however, is that the United Nations Commission studied the problem, took testimony from everybody. The Turi Karta testified. Everybody testified. There's a famous story here about political correctness. Is that there was a picture of Rav Dushinsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was the Rav of Eda Haredes, so he was one of those who testified that because they heard from all sections of the Jewish society. So he testified, so next to him was a woman, a stenographer, who was taking the minutes of the testimony. So, sitting next to a woman. So in the picture, they took a picture of him testifying. So 20 years later, when they got hold of the picture, so they painted a beard on the woman. But they neglected to realize that she was wearing a skirt. So when the picture was published, it either was a Scotsman or it was a woman with a beard, right? But in the next issue, they corrected it because they only showed it from the waist up, right? They cut out the bottom completely. So if you see the picture today, he's not sitting next to a woman. I'd be the same as Kinski would ever sit next to a woman. So that's, political correctness. How to fix up the world.
And what the Federal Bank supports authorizing.
To a great extent, they did. To a great extent, they did. And both the Yergun and the Stern Gang were disproportionately Haredi Jews from Haredi families. What then happened was that the commission, after hearing all the testimony, came up with a surprise. They came up with a partition plan. So we're going to divide the country. It'll be a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jewish state was gerrymandered. It was cut into pieces. It was maybe a third of what we have today. But the Jews accepted it. Herzog said then, it's the beginning. He said, we'll see, God will take care of the rest. Whatever they give us, we'll take. The Arabs rejected it completely. The Palestinians, they wanted a state, could have had it in 1948. Could have a bigger state than they'll ever have in their lives. But they didn't do it. And in order for the report of the commission to be binding on the United Nations, it required a two-thirds vote in its favor in the General Assembly of the United Nations, something which today would be impossible to get anything pro-Jewish. And here a great confluence of strange things happened. Stalin, who was a terrible anti-Semite, somehow became convinced that if there was a Jewish state, it would be communist. He believed that the leftists here would take it over. And it would be a foothold for Soviet Union in the Middle East. He also desired to get England out at any cost, because he had dreams of taking over Persia and Iraq and Iran, the whole thing. So Russia supported the resolution. The only time that Russia and the United States were on the same side on a major issue for maybe 50 years. The United States supported it. The Catholic Church opposed it. The Catholic countries voted against it. And the Arabs voted against it. But the European country, England abstained. European countries voted for it out of that sense of guilt as to what had happened in Europe, which was still fresh in their minds. And then there were other funny stories, right? The representative of one of the governments was instructed to vote no. He came to the assembly and he was drunk and he voted yes. There are many interesting chapters if you read the history of Israel, just fascinating. And it passed 33-13. They need the 32 to have the two-thirds. They got 33. That was November 29, 1947, that the partition plan was accepted. England was forced to say that they would abide by it. The next day, November 30th, the war began. Arab militias all over the country. Jews were killed. It was a war. The Jews were very poorly armed. The British armed the Arabs. British soldiers fought on the side of the Arab militia. Much of the Arab militia was officered by British men, British officers. The Jordanian, Transjordan, the Arab Legion, which was the best Arab army, invaded, captured the old city of Jerusalem, drove out the Jews who had lived there, turned the plaza in front of the Kotel into a garbage pit, and desecrated the graves on Mount of Olives. But the Jews fought, and they fought hard. And they smuggled arms. America piously made an arms embargo so that the Jews couldn't buy. The English were arming the Arabs. The Jews had nowhere to buy arms. So the Jews smuggled arms. There was a Jew by the name of Hank Greenspan, who was the editor of the Las Vegas Sun. Strange person, but he sat in jail for sending arms to Israel. There were all sorts of arms smugglers. The Jewish mafia in America sent over millions of dollars. Gilda Meir writes in her memoirs that she was at a parlor meeting of the Jewish mafia, right? You got invited to the parlor meeting, you came. And, you know, everybody brought envelopes with cash. Because it was such a time that, you know, it all Jews felt that if it doesn't happen, God forbid, we're through. So everything was invested in.
So didn't the British officers issue Black Relief from the United Nations for many of the...
It's all, you know... And because of the war, the United Nations itself wavered. The American State Department was against it. George Marshall, who was the American Secretary of State, told Truman that he was going to resign and that he would campaign against him in the 1948 election if Truman went ahead with it. And Truman looked him in the eye and said, George, you do what you have to do and I'll do what I have to do. Marshall did not resign. But the State Department was and still is basically very Arabist, not friendly to the Jewish cause. It's the President and the Congress in the United States that have carried whatever benefits the State of Israel has from America, and they're considerable. But then what happened was that, again, Stalin and his weirdness allowed Czechoslovakia, which was then under communist rule already, in Czechoslovakia there's a Skoda works. They make cars now. They used to make tanks and machine guns. They're one of the largest arms manufacturers. And Shimon Peres made the deal. The Jewish state owes a lot to Shimon Peres, prior to what we may think of his politics. There would not be a nuclear facility without Peres. He's the one that did it with France. And he's the one that got the checks. So they got arms. They started to get arms. It was bought with American money, American Jewish money. And they smuggled the arms in. In the middle of all of this, the war with the Arabs, there was a Jewish civil war between the Irgun and the Haganah. The Irgun attempted to bring in a ship called the Altalena. loaded with arms, and they said that we want the arms. And Gurion said, the arms go, we're not going to have any more private militias. They didn't agree, so the Haganah shelled the ship and blew it up in Tel Aviv Harbor. 13 Jews were killed. The commander of the operation who blew up the ship was Yitzhak Rabin. The British announced that they're leaving on May 15, 1948. May 15th was Shabbat. Ben-Gurion, there was a meeting of the leading council of the Yishuv. Ben-Gurion forced through a resolution that they would declare a Jewish state. Many of them were afraid to declare a Jewish state. The vote, I think, was 6-4. But then he drew up this very uninspired Declaration of Independence. They had Jefferson write it. And they all signed on it. Communist Jews signed on it. The head of Agudas Yisrael, Yitzhak Meir Levine, signed on it. The religious Jews signed on it. Socialists signed on it. Everybody signed on it. And because it was May 15th was Shabbat, so May 14th, Friday afternoon, Ben-Gurion declared the state. And an hour later, Egyptian bombers bombed Tel Aviv. And Israel was attacked on all sides. 7 Arab armies invaded Israel. Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, the Palestinian militia, Yemen, Aden, Egypt. And the Egyptians came to within 18 kilometers of Yerushalayim. And they were held off at Ramat Rachel, which is a kibbutz today, it's a banquet hall, you know, near Tal Biot. They tried to come up to Tel Aviv. They came within 19 kilometers of Tel Aviv before they were stopped. And then the Jews went on the offensive. And what happened is that the Palestinian Arabs were defeated in a number of very serious battles, and they started to flee. The Arabs themselves said that they should leave the country because they interfered with the war effort. After the Jews were destroyed, they'd all come back and get the Jewish property. The Jews also encouraged them to flee. Deir Yassin, which today is Har Nof, there was a Yirgun attacked, and over 250 Arab civilians were killed. That started a flight from the entire area. So Begin denied that there was any, that they said that they were shot at, etc., and what happens in war. But what happened was that by July, it was obvious that the Jews were not going to be crushed. So the Arabs asked for a ceasefire, which the United Nations granted them. In the ceasefire, both sides rearmed, the Jews with the Czech arms, the Arabs with British arms, and the war began again. By November, the Arabs were pretty much defeated. The Jews even invaded the Sinai. Britain threatened that if the Jews didn't go out of the Sinai, they would come into war against on the side of the Arabs. They'd send the British Army. As a parting shot, the Israeli Air Force, which then was a hodgepodge of old Messerschmitts and smuggled British Spitfires and whatever they could lay their hands on, as a final parting shot, they shot down 4 British planes. When they did that, the British government said that they're going into the war, and Gurion apologized and withdrew from the Sinai. And the next year, in January, armistice talks began, and the lines were drawn where the battles ended. That's what's called the Green Line today. Those were the lines of 1948-49, with the provision that the armistice agreements would all turn into peace agreements, which they never did, with the exception of Egypt and Jordan, which are notable exceptions. The state was declared on Friday. The headline in Hamodia, which is the newspaper of Agudas Yisrael, on Sunday was Boruch Shechiyonu V'Kimonu V'Gionu L'Azman Hazeh. I cannot tell you what people felt. It was like an electric moment. I remember walking to shul that Friday night with my father. My father's an Eastern European Jew, a Lithuanian Jew. Father, he was never a very emotional person on the outside. And he wept all the way to shul. And I said to him, "Well, why are you crying?" He said, "Well," he said, "you'll get older, you'll understand." So it had a moment to it. And at that moment, Rabbanut declared this Yom HaTzmaut celebration as a commemoration of the establishment of the Jewish state after 2,000 years. We are the only comeback in history. Nobody ever came back. No comebacks. England's never going to own Hong Kong again. We're the only comeback in history. And so a lot of things have happened in 56 years. There are a lot of state undoubtedly has not fulfilled its promise to any of the groups of the Jews. It's not socialist, it's not communist, it's not capitalist, it's not religious, it's not secular, it's not Froom, it's not Froom. Right? It's a hodgepodge. But what it did is it brought together Jews from 102 countries, from 82 different languages, and somehow made a people out of them. Also, no one ever did that. And no one ever did it under these circumstances. And it built itself into a first world country. And it has the greatest concentration of Torah study in one location since undoubtedly the time of the Babylonian Talmud, if not even greater than that. A rebirth of Torah that no one could have imagined. And it has other things. It has high tech, and it has universities, and biotech, and it makes the best machine gun in the world, and all sorts of things. A bunch of crossy Jews, tailors, shoemakers. The leading country in the world in terms of agriculture. Highest yield per acre in the world. So I don't know what to say. I don't know. Nobody knows what to say, right? This is like I used to say that it's like sometimes, you know, God is funny. So he gives a 50-year-old woman a baby. What do you do with it? Right? Babies are when you're 20 and 30, right? But it's here. The main thing is that it's here. You got 5.5 million Jews living here. Also, a number that never was equaled before. And in spite of everything, it is a Jewish state. It just was remarked, I was in America, so in America, Shavuos is a non-existent holiday. It doesn't exist. It only exists amongst us, right? But You ask, tell the average American Jew, you know, the Shavuot, he says, what are you talking about, right? Yeah, you know, you'll ask the biggest secularist, you know, he knows there's a Shavuot, you know. And the country is much more traditional. But we're caught up in politics and in personalities and in difficult situations and in what's the right policy and what's the wrong policy. And basically, we're 56 years later, so a lot of the people that say now don't remember what was then. The Ponovizhi Rav said to me, the Ponovizhi Yeshiva, tomorrow in Bnei Brak, they fly the Israeli flag from the top mast of the building in the middle of Bnei Brak. One of probably the 10 flags in Bnei Brak. So he said to me, I remember he said to me in Miami Beach, he said, you know, the Kanoim came to me, he said, the religious people came to me and they said, how can you fly the Israeli flag? So I said to him, Rebbe, what did you say? So he said, you know, in Lithuania, in Ponovich, on Lithuanian Independence Day, I flew the Lithuanian flag from the top of the yeshiva. I want you to know it's not worse here. It's not worse here. And so I think that really is the perspective.
Why is it that...
I don't know. Believe me, I don't know. I can't figure it out. I can't figure out people who don't have a Hakoras Hatov for others who lay down their lives for us so that we can sit here. Last night a border policeman was killed. Don't I at least have the necessity to say thank you for saving me? Whether I believe in you or I don't believe, whatever, right? The army is matzil us, saves us. So it couldn't be without the Rabbeinu Shalem, right? But that doesn't change the fact what they're doing. So I don't understand. I tell you absolutely, I don't understand. I don't understand what we're angry about. Were you angry about Tommy Lapid? Tommy Lapid is minor league compared to what was 100 years ago. They don't know what was 100 years ago. They don't know the Bund had its annual banquet Kol Nidre night in Vilna, a block and a half from the Dome. Nobody in our country would do that today. So it's a slow process, right? We've exiled 2,000 years. It takes a little while to work it out of us. And we came with a lot of baggage. You ever get off of Ben-Gurion Airport and see the baggage? If you was coming, nobody comes with baggage. So. Unbelievable. Every time I come back, we came back, with, you know, after Pesach and this jumbo, and the baggage was just unbelievable. Jews come with a lot of baggage, right? So we came here with a lot of baggage. We got all the baggage from the exile. The whole 2,000 years is here. We don't need anything. So it's all here, right? So we got to work it out. So it may not be worked out in my lifetime, maybe in my grandchildren's life, but it'll get worked out. It's better. It's much better. Better than it was 50 years ago, 60 years ago. I always walk by, I live in Rehavia. The next neighbor is Talbiya. Talbiya was all Arabs. They were shooting. The Knesset Anasi, they got a shell in it. Okay, so, no one says it's easy, and no one says it's perfect. But it's here, and we're living here, so... As I'll say, and with this I conclude this noble lecture, who is a person that inherits the world to come? Gemara Pesachim, Kufiyut Gimel. The Gemara says three things. Ador b'Eretz Yisrael, someone who lives in Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because it's never been easy to live in Eretz Yisrael. Not from the first day on. It's easier to live in Brooklyn, believe me. door of Eretz Yisrael. I'm a gadol bon of Torah, and he raises generations to study and appreciate Torah. Ba'amavdil ala kos shel yayin, and he's able to make havdola. He's able to make a difference between kodesh lachol, between oil lachoshech, and yisrael la'amim. He's able to divide, to see the differences. Those three things. So that's ben olam habor. So here we're ador Eretz Yisrael. Baruch Hashem, we have a chance to learn Torah, and we're trying to make avdola. So we can't really complain too much. Have to be grateful for what we have. Enjoy yourselves.